The other thing that I think people really underestimate is the regenerative power of this planet.
Totally.
Of the regenerative, like, healing capabilities of this planet.
It's self-healing.
It's self-healing. Mm. We just have to stop poisoning it all the time.
We just got to take a step back and let it breathe. The pandemic. We learned so much during the pandemic.
Hello, and welcome to the New Humans for New Earth podcast. I'm Queenie, your host. And for anyone just joining us for the first time, on this podcast, we believe that every human alive today has a role to play in helping to co-create a new, more loving, and more aligned world. Here, we introduce you to wisdom, perspectives, and information to support and inspire you in making more aligned choices in your life. And we identify concrete actions you can take right now to help bring about the kinder, more compassionate, more loving, more unified world we all know is possible. In today's episode, I want to talk with you about a subject that deeply impacts us all: pollinators. Pollinators play a critical role in our food supply, as well as the complex ecosystems that make up our natural world. They are known as keystone species, which means that without them, the ecosystems in which they play a role would literally fall apart. And as the manifesto called World Scientists' Warning to Humanity notes, hundreds of thousands of species of pollinators are at risk of extinction in coming decades because of choices that we are making. But solutions to this problem are available and implementable right now. Here to speak with me today is my good friend Nick Johnson. Nick is a U.S. Air Force Special Operations veteran. He has degrees in environmental science, focusing on landscape ecology and geospatial information analytics. Since 2017, he has worked with the Bonneville Power Administration as a natural resource manager and senior environmental protection specialist. His work focuses on helping promote pollinator habitat along BPA's 15,000 miles of transmission lines, as well as spearheading the development of BPA's pollinator habitat preservation efforts. He's here today in his personal capacity to share his deep knowledge about the situation facing our pollinator species. Please join me in welcoming Nick Johnson to the New Humans for New Earth podcast.
Thanks for having me, Queenie. Pleasure is all mine.
Aw, thank you so much for being here, and thank you for being a new human.
Loving it. A little scary at times, but yeah.
Right?
Awareness is key, but you know, with good awareness comes a lot of good responsibility.
Yeah, you know, it's been an honor to get to witness some of your awakening journey. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems like it kind of came on a bit unexpectedly for you.
Yeah. No shortage of trauma, but for some reason, you know, I finally got the last bit of trauma I might have, or one more puzzle piece to like really unlock that the breakthrough. So and then it's like, well, so you can't put that back in the bag.
Can't put it back.
It's out. So
yeah. And it's kind of this like ever evolving journey, but
totally.
It's been neat watching you.
Yeah. It's uncanny to see how all the things that you go through in life, how they all kind of fall in, and you're like, oh, that's why I had to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in the moment you're like, I don't want to do it. Here we are. Better for it now, I guess.
Neat. For those folks who haven't thought about pollinators since we learned about them in grade school, could you just give us a little bit of a rundown of what a pollinator is?
We're talking about the birds and the bees, because literally it's animal. Like when we speak about pollinators, I mean, there's a lot of different types of pollinators. We're pollinators too, right?
Mm.
We can pick up stuff, but we're talking mainly about like animal or insect pollinators. So all kinds of bugs, you know. People think about bees, but there's flies. There's all kinds of different birds, bats.
And then pollinators do what again?
Oh, yeah. Skip that part. So, you know, they're very instrumental on plant reproduction. So, you know, plants can't get up and move around to do their business. So they have their minions do it. So they put out their nice little beautiful scents and flowers to attract those birds and the bees that come and, you know, eat the pollen and drink the nectar. And then, you know, so mechanically what's happening is the pollen goes from one species to the next plant over, and then boom, you got plant reproduction. This is, you know, we can get into the weeds about it, but it's, in essence, so yeah, this what the so it's a symbiotic relationship, right? So the plant is giving energy, you know, like carbon's energy, which is, you know, originally light, because we're all light. So it's stored light. It's awesome that plants figured out how to do that, right? But so they sacrifice some of that to give nutrients to their, you know, because they realize that they're part of the collective, and they have been, right? So like, look, you take care of me, I'll take care of you. You get to eat a little bit, just help me make my kids. So that bee goes from one to the other, and it's all comes back around. It's a circle of life. So, but like in a really profound way. And, you know, you see that a lot in nature and ecology. Everything is a circle. It's like give and take.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's beautiful to sort of see how all of that fits together.
It's simple.
Yeah.
Yeah. Literally, I was reading about this, and I was like, when I come across it, I was like, we're literally talking about birds and bees dying. And then like, I hear us just talk about the birds and the bees. I'm like, is that really what they meant by it? Did we get it wrong? But, you know, we think about it, it's pollinating. So it's like the adage there is, you know, it's really a meta phrase there. I had a good giggle about that.
Now, the pollinator I think we're all most familiar with is the bee, right? And the UN estimates that something like 71 out of 100 of the crops that we rely on in our daily diet are pollinated by bees. Can you give us a sense of sort of the extent of the decline in the bee population?
Yeah, in some areas, like 90%.
Oh,
you
wow.
know, of like native bee populations, there's a ton of bees in the Pacific Northwest. Like, there's like 300 or so, and about half of them are imperiled at some point.
Wow.
You know, like 200,000 or so bees in North America, and they estimate, you know, we're losing them so fast that we're like realizing that some of these bees are actually, you know, as evolutionary tracks happen, that we're losing them faster than we can keep track of them evolving, or they're, you know, trying to adapt to. So there's like some nuances there with the actual numbers, but generally stating is it's like pretty consistent across the board that there's massive declines in all insects, and unfortunately bees are one of them. And we're seeing it in like the European honeybees, what everyone associates with like pollinators. We bring them in, we put them in the nice little boxes out, and the honey's great. but, you know, we're just seeing colony collapse there and some other just genetic disorders that will happen. But, you know, generally what's happening is they're getting out and eating some of the stuff that causes that, neonicotinoids, which is a fancy chemical introduced in the 80s as a safer alternative. Is actually, you know, it targets species like aphids and that type of stuff on a lot of our seed crops. But unfortunately, the untargeted species being the bees and others are, you know, getting into them. It's kind of a repeat of the DDT epidemic that we saw with eagles and other raptors, you know, of like the early 40s and then on, where we sprayed DDT over everything to increase crop yields. So,
right. And if I recall from school, like DDT, like bioaccumulates and sort of those apex,
apex predators, apex species.
Apex species, right. Of which we are one.
Yeah, we are. Yeah. And that's the same where we're uncovering more and more science. It's hard to, you know, it's relatively new on this stage of chemicals, you know, and neonicotinoids. Were, you know, most of our agriculture seeds are coated with some type of, you know, anti-fungicide and that stuff, because you don't want it to spoil, you know, in storage. And also you don't want them little like bugs getting in there and eating all your stuff. You come by your sack of seeds and comes to selling them, and it's like, oh, someone had a heyday. So unfortunately, that, you know, the neonicotinoids are actually like a nicotine base. So historically, I believe they used to put like tobacco leaves in the seed houses to help, you know, ward off. It's kind of like the marigolds around your garden, you know, to keep certain bugs away. And then they, you know, synthesized it in a lab.
Of course.
In Switzerland. And we're like, oh, this is great. We can do this. And then, so that's kind of the gist of it is anywhere this product is being utilized in agriculture, you're seeing, you know, over the course of a few decades, extreme declines in insects.
Is it just
neonicotinoids?
Neonicotinoids.
So there's others too, like fungicides as well that will, you know, have dramatic, but the neonicotinoids are problematic for bee species because the width they impact their neurotoxin. So they make them all confused. They can't navigate. So bees are really like, some people don't know this, but they're extremely smart. They use the vibration of their wings to talk to each other. So like when they have that, you know, they're all high on nicotine, essentially. We're all a chemical derivative of nicotine. So you think of like, it's kind of like the fentanyl. You know, they're having their own little fentanyl epidemic, you know, in their own way, right?
Oh,
so, like, because, yeah, fentanyl is a synthetic, you know, derivative as well of a plant compound. So that's how I, you know, my school brain makes it into the human brain to make it, like, relatable. And so, yeah, so what happens is they fly around, they get all confused, they can't, you know, navigate. It takes them longer, they expend more resources, and then sometimes it has them dying when they get too much of it. They're eating the pollen that has that on there, so then it's getting in our honey. So it's like, you know, they say that it's safe for humans at a certain level, but what's that level? You know, when we start having it on all our food,
right?
You know, you look at it like a single exposure, but bioaccumulation as well. If you're not taking, and we see this all the time, right, with weird cancers and stuff, and you know, the anthropogenic outbreaks of a lot of things that we classify as, oh, that's genetic. More times than not, we're finding out it's environmental. That's kind of why I'm in the job I'm in right now, because it's like, no, this isn't. It's what you're eating and what we're allowing to be put on our food. It's sad, but you can also use the animals too when they start declining. It is kind of like it's the canary in the coal mine, right?
Yes.
And people like Silent Spring, so it's a very popular book for people to read. Talk about when there's no birds singing, you know. And birds being a pollinator, things that eat pollinators, and you start seeing, we're also seeing a massive reduction of all species. You know, David Attenborough talks about this.
Yeah.
And it's quite dire, but, you know, like, when are we going to listen to the canary in our coal mine?
You already kind of pointed to this, but something that I was surprised to learn is that these impacts to pollinators, like, populations actually extends to managed bee colonies as well. So, for instance, what I'm reading is that, like, back in the 1940s, we had something like 5 million managed bee colonies, but today we only have, like, 2.68 million. What's driving that decline? And, you know, like, what are the pressures on these managed bee populations?
Well, some of it is we farm a lot differently now, is one of them. Well, we grow a lot more crops that don't require bees, like corn, you know, is one of them. And then you have wheat as well as a wind. But so you have to kind of acknowledge that, you know, a lot of land is going to more valuable crop production.
So is it just like a decrease in demand?
There's some of that there, but there's also the decrease of the profitability of running them because of this. You know, some independent beekeepers go out of business quite soon because of these colony collapses. And there's a few different issues, one of them being we talked about the insect, you know, literally they're going out and eating poison and dying. So you can imagine as a small business is burning money at that point, right? And also they have some, there's other issues that come in, and you know, when you're using European honeybees, it's a single species, so we created a vacuum of pollinators by clearing out land that was very diverse. And then, you know, you rely on now just one species, it's ripe for, you know, a disease or something to go through and wipe out and be concentrated to have that issue. So there's probably a little bit of that going on there too. Nuancely, there's those other external drivers there, but the biggest reason is most beekeepers are losing a lot of money due to the fact that their bees are eating poison and dying.
Well, and And you said the word diversity in there, right?
Yeah.
And sort of what I'm reading, right, is like one of the major drivers of the colony collapse, and please correct me if I'm wrong, right? But there's like, okay, so we're renting these bee colonies to mm-hmm. come in and pollinate monoculture fields, mm-hmm. right? So they're just having one crop. And one of the things that happens with monoculture or monocropping, right, is extensive use of pesticides.
Yeah.
In addition, the lack of diversity in the diet for the bee colonies yeah. that are coming to these monocropped fields lacks diversity. So these bees end up being undernourished. Mm-hmm. And then in addition to that, they're having to then literally fly and live and eat this food, for them food, right, mm-hmm. that is poisoned mm-hmm. by pesticides, by the overuse of pesticides. And so those two things together, it's like you get, I mean, and then yeah. it leads to this colony yeah. collapse,
yeah.
right?
So it's, you're talking about habitat fragmentation and lack of floral resources, right, mm-hmm. which is also something that's right there with the pesticides. Mm-hmm. Thank you for reminding me that. I'm like, the chemicals, they're bad. Stop putting poison on everything.
We right.
just, because humans just not do that. You know,
yeah.
it's like we've created this magic thing. And like, if you just let nature nurture itself, right?
Yes.
So you'll see that like we're getting wise about that, where, you know, if you leave people up to their own devices, they might go to the cheaper route of, you know, using the chemicals and stuff. But really, and we've said this in other things, when you're taking the cheaper route, a lot of times a little bit of money you're saving is actually a lot worse in the future. You're like robbing, you know, tenfold in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So, but habitat fragmentation is also largely to attribute to those like species decline too. But projects like mine and my master's degree, looking at like how do we reconnect this, right? Because
right.
bees, they want to, if they got to fly, it's a lot of work for
mm-hmm.
little guys to go from. They're busy, but you know, if they got to go a far amount of time, you know, they want to come back to their hives, right?
Yeah.
So you'll see that like in a lot of other countries, in here included, on the West Coast and all across, that there is incentives for farmers to have the like crop rotations and having the wildflower meadows and stuff, because
mm-hmm.
you know, if you're having alfalfa or whatever, like that only flowers at one point and then it goes to, you know, the seeds go to seed and then the flowers aren't there from them anymore. So they really have to have those other resources nearby. And, you know, we kind of got that wrong in a while, leaving it just up to the market. You know,
mm-hmm.
people are like, well, I'm not going to plant a wildflower meadow, it doesn't pay me anything. So, you know, the government has to come in. And a lot of times it's subsidized through some types of taxation on whatever entity, right? But
mm-hmm.
So, yeah, my project that I worked on and my master's and what I'm working on for my employer is how do we take land that's, you know, there, that goes everywhere. Like we have literally power lines all over the Northwest
mm-hmm.
and they act as like a little highway for species.
I really appreciate that you refer to pesticides as poison.
Oh, that's what it is.
Because that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is. And you know, like it's so normalized
mm-hmm.
for us that we use pesticides on our crops. And those, like, you know, organic farmers so often will say, it's ridiculous that we have to say that our stuff is organic
totally.
Because it should just be that our stuff is food and the other stuff
food.
Is chemical
mm.
or poisoned food,
totally.
Basically.
You know, you buy a pack of cigarettes and there's all these warnings on it, right?
Yes.
You buy the chemical that they're putting in, and you can watch any of these farm shows, right? They
mm-hmm.
show the truck just going spraying it. And if you look at the EPA labels and all the warnings on it,
mm-hmm.
on these stuff that they're putting on our food, when you buy a bag of bread, I just read a recent report after yesterday. It was like it was one brand out of like all these sampled, like all had glyphosate on it,
mm.
you know, and like not to get into that, but it's like, when are we going to have these warning labels on the bread? You start
mm-hmm.
looking at some of these chemicals and it's like, why is a farm, like this chemical company is also a pharmaceutical company, you know? And then they're like creating the cancer and then,
yeah.
what do you got to take to combat the cancer? Well, of course, they're going to know exactly what drug to give you because, you know, they're doing the research on both sides. The target species for a lot of this isn't the bees, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the aphids
mm-hmm.
that eat the crops. So it comes down to losing money per yield. So it's like, well, or you can lose an entire yield, people don't eat. You know, mm-hmm. So there is some, like, humans need, you know, we need to balance it, right? But we've created this wonderful solution of using chemicals, and they're really effective.
Right.
But
in the short term.
In the short term, right? You get more calories, mm-hmm. but those calories are tainted, you know? And then and there's that, you talk about just, we're looking at, like, you know, ecosystem collapse. Well, what's the human, you know, anthropogenic impacts from healthcare?
Right.
In this country, we're spending a lot of money on cancer.
Well, right. And I mean, that's what's really interesting for me, right, is because, okay, there's like a few things going on with what you just said, right? There's this short-term perspective. How do I increase crop yields now? Mm-hmm. How do I solve this pest problem now,
yeah.
right? And you kind of mentioned earlier this, well, you know, these chemicals or pesticides or poisons, like, are not harmful to humans in this sort of concentration, mm-hmm. right? But then you have bioaccumulation. You have people who are eating food that has this sprayed on it mm-hmm. day in, day out for years.
Yeah.
And it's on everything.
It's in your drinks. Yeah.
Right. And then, you know, and then it's impacting our pollinator mm-hmm. species, right? And, you know, it just becomes this, like, systemic problem.
Yeah.
And then sort of to think about it from another perspective, it's like, you know, and to go back to something you said earlier, it's like our ecosystems are so complex.
Totally. Everything's connected.
Everything's connected. And nature, when left on its own, left to its own devices, is abundant.
So efficient. It's so efficient. It's almost like a divine entity created it. You know? It's like, here, what are you guys doing? Literally, you didn't have to do this. You're creating problems.
You
like,
were creating problems.
Like, yeah, you, like, stop sweeping the dirt road. Just let it be a dirt road, you know?
Right.
Like, but it is kind of funny. Like, we're like, we've got it. And then we're like, shit.
You're right.
Like, we don't have it. But then if you do leave nature, it is like everything is connected, right? Like, since the 16th century, we've been trying to farm for population growth, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we've gotten it right and wrong at the same time, like, mm-hmm. so embarrassingly.
Yeah.
Like, you know, because civilizations, you, like, you know, the written record, like, you see these places, like, what happened? They collapsed their food. You know, they had to move.
You know, the other thing about sort of natural environments that we have removed from, like, modern industrialized agriculture, right? And you kind of pointed to this earlier, is like when you have these monocrop fields, mm-hmm. they're much more susceptible to pests.
Totally.
Because you get one pest in there and the whole crop is lost.
It's a locust, you know?
Yeah, because and you've removed, like, all of the biodiversity, all of the obstacles mm-hmm. to those pests, right? Destroying that crop. And it's like we're starting to realize that this is not the way to do it.
Totally.
Right? But there's also very much this push to be like, well, I mean, we can just fix it with more chemicals.
Yeah. It's like Dreyzick is a really good writer, and I read a lot of his books in my studies. And it's like all these discourses, right? Mm. And I don't remember them because I didn't convert all that to memory, shocker. But, you know, we think about this, like, human, like, the discourse of, oh, we'll just engineer our way out of it. We engineer our way into it, you know. We talk about moving these plants somewhere else. Also, like, these outbreaks happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because soybeans, right? Those aphids in China, that's where they're from, they also had predators that loved to eat them,
mm.
right? So we'll see that here. We're, you know, introducing the Japanese beetle, for example.
Mm.
It was like it was a biocontrol to the aphid outbreaks. You know, we were like, well, we'll just bring in this beetle. And then I was like, it just wreaked havoc, right? Because then all
right.
of a sudden, but it worked. You know, they got rid of the pests. So sometimes, you know, at least in this country, the USDA has used other types of controls than chemicals, right? But when you always look at the balance sheet, the chemicals end up being cheaper, but what's the long-term cost never
yes.
gets talked about in
yeah.
the boardrooms and, you know, when they're trading stocks. You know,
right.
the liability isn't being paid out on the true cost of stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The true cost of this isn't representative. It's just the front face manufacturing cost. That's it.
Right.
And you look back at, like, Dow Chemical when they... where I'm from, my headquarters. That's why I'm passionate about this, is like they lost, you know, the dioxin. It's the largest fine they ever had to pay. And even then, it wasn't the total amount, right? But until you really start equating that into there, yeah, the chemicals are going to be cheaper, but it's artificial, you know.
Well, and you pointed to this earlier, too, but it's like, so now we have these companies that are both creating the pesticides and also the medicine
totally
that people need to get better from the cancers and other sicknesses mm-hmm. that are caused by ingesting these pesticides.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, in a sense, they have no incentive to care about sort of the long-term, bigger picture costs because they're winning on both sides.
Yeah, you'd think the moral objective reasoning would come in at some point in the Bond villain story, but mm-hmm. like, yeah. And, you know, really what it comes down to is all of us working together collectively. If you leave it up to the market, yeah, it's going to screw us over because somebody's going to want to get paid and have another yacht. It's just like, unfortunately, the human condition in the current moment.
Right.
But yeah, like, but there is a lot of people who care about this.
Yeah.
And, you know, and some of these companies that are starting to realize that when they start getting hit with these fines and their yachts taken away, they're like, all right, maybe we should, you know, invest yeah. in that. And so there is some research there too. So I don't want to, yeah. it's not entirely doom and gloom, but yeah.
But also consumers need to know. I mean,
absolutely.
Like people need to understand that it is not a choice between more expensive luxury organic food or conventional food.
It's poison.
No.
Poison.
It's a choice between nutritious, healthy food that will actually lead yeah. to a vibrant life versus poison food.
Absolutely.
Right? And as far as like our power as consumers in the market, it's like we need to just stop supporting conventionally grown food because it is not serving us, it's not serving the environment, it's not serving the ecosystem, mm-hmm. which we need to have an environment to live in, mm-hmm. right? And I mean, so again, thank you so much for just calling it poison.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Not, unfortunately, we don't have the skull and crossbones on it quite yet.
Not but. Yet.
So for my personal journey, you know, I didn't really realize it because I was somebody that like, you know, it's expensive to buy the organic. But when I was growing up, we ate organic. Mm-hmm. My dad was like, we're not putting that much. We did the things because like the traditional ways of farming in the books, you know, didn't. This is pre-chemical adaptation. You know, we talk about my grandpa, like had these pictures, these giant squat, like massive. Mm-hmm. And he was just using like literally poop tea, like manure tea, right?
Yeah.
But like, you know, they were, there's other things out there that, you know, there's lots of books out there of the old remedies. And like, we talk about like hanging tobacco leaves in your seed storage shed and mm-hmm. like whatever that was, you know,
yeah.
We talk about this kind of stuff and it worked, you mm-hmm. know, but back when we were feeding ourselves locally and didn't rely on a machine, like the giant industrialization of it, which has been great for population. Like,
sure.
If you just want to make more humans, man, we're doing it right. But like, what's the quality of life there?
Yeah.
You know, I would have to argue that, you know, times were hard, you know, tough when you had to grow your food behind the house. But speaking from experience, I remember it being quite cool to just walk out there and pluck a radish out of the ground and eat it. You
yes.
know, so we have to think about that too. As you reduce the need for stuff to be worrying about yields for shelf stability, because no one's growing anything anymore. Everyone's living in their monoculture. Another habitat fragmentation is we build houses here like we're all 17th century Victorian monarchs. You know, we have our quite, you know, like our lawn that's like English clover, like
right.
you know, or whatever this is, right? And it's like, you know, that was a vibrant grassland before or something mm-hmm. else, you know. And so even looking at like what we consider as what's normal, you know, it's like humans, like for a little bit, I figured there's a study out there like a couple years and then you're like, oh, that's what that's supposed to look like now, mm-hmm. you know. And it's just like, but if you let that person grow their grass long for 2 years, then you're just used to that being a meadow, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's along the same lines there too, where you can make it relatable, like, and not make these choices, you know, grow your food in your backyard or whatever it is.
I like what you said though about bringing it back local, because
yeah.
you know, I mean, first of all, it just cuts down on so many emissions and all this stuff, and also bad practices, right?
Mm-hmm.
But also like what I've experienced and observed just as far as bringing it back local is that humans want to do right.
Mm-hmm.
Generally,
absolutely,
by other humans, you know,
we're they all take, very similar. Yeah.
Yeah, they take pride and joy in creating a beautiful product or growing delicious mm-hmm. food, right? And you just don't see that
everywhere
in the mega corporations, the industrialized agriculture. You know, it's so much more a business, a bottom line, a frankly dehumanized system.
It's kind of like pulling you away from your body too, right?
You mentioned something a little bit ago about being like 17th century monarchs. And this is, it's so funny you say this because I was literally, I just voice noted a friend of mine earlier this morning about the same concept, right? Because, it can be kind of hard to see, but I think there's something here, right? Like, there is something in our culture where we are still just like so enthralled with the idea of royalty.
Posh, yeah.
Than the aristocracy.
Totally.
Right? And in particular, attempting to recreate that kind of lifestyle and status in our own lives. Mm-hmm. Right? So, like you mentioned lawns, right? That used to be a status symbol.
Totally. It still is,
right? But like, but the origin, right, behind the lawn is I have so much property that this piece, this expanse of land doesn't need to be productive. It's actually just going to be a decorative lawn.
I want to look at it.
Yes.
I shall look at my green lawn.
Right. Mm. And in some places they even have signs, don't walk here. This is not for walking. This is just...
We both live in England.
Right.
And like, you walk across that lawn, don't do it. You know, that Midwest barefoot kid in me was like, I'm going to walk across that lawn. And then you do it.
Right.
Yeah.
But then I see it also manifesting in just like all of the ways that we expect and even demand convenience, right? And it's funny because, you know, I see this and it's like our convenience concept has moved to such an extreme that yes, it might be convenient, but the thing that you're actually getting is crap.
Yeah.
You know, it's low quality.
It's slightly better to pick up your dog poop from, you know?
Yeah.
In the grand scheme of things. It's like, interesting, we're bringing up lawns. One of the projects I worked on at work was like, we're paying to water this thing. We're paying a company to cut this thing. If you just let it be a wildflower meadow, it just is.
Yeah.
You've reduced all that. Because it's like, that meadow doesn't need to be, if you're doing a locally appropriate seed mix, it will just grow. It's great. And then, like, all year, a new one comes up and flowers. It's amazing. And we're seeing, like, huge cost savings benefits. And it's like the same with, like, underneath the solar panels, too. It's just, it's thinking about, like, dual use of these spaces. And so we showed it at work. Like, and our like, some of the people were like, the facilities guys that have to manage all this, we're like, yes, give us less. We have too much, or it's costing us too much because the year over year. So, you know, it asks you, like, at what point we're seeing our economy is getting expensive, and people going to stop having lawns because it's like, some of these people, you're paying to water it, and you're paying a guy to cut it. It's like, you're not even cutting your grass anymore. Like, why do you need it?
Yeah.
I think of that stuff. So it's like, you know, I don't water my lawn. I let the thing go dormant. You know, but, and also I don't have a lot of grass at my house, but that's also because I grew up poor and frugal. It's like, I'm not watering that.
Yeah.
Let it go. Dormant, it'll come back.
Right.
So, but yeah, like, it's reframing what it should look like all the time. And, you know, grasses aren't supposed to be green all the time everywhere on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
They are in England because it rains there. It's a giant, literally garden. But, you know, not everywhere is like that. So it's like, yeah, we can't be these monarchs of, and it really does boil down to the, you know, the English did conquer the world, so to speak, and they went everywhere. So it's unfortunately the aristocracy of the French and English really did still have a lasting impact on most of humanity.
Yes. And, you know, I mean, to bring it back to people's daily lives also, I mean, it's gotten to the point where, yeah, you can have your own domain. It might be like a 500 square foot, one bedroom apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you might be able to have someone like deliver like food to your door, you know, and shoot. I mean, if you have a little extra income, you can get someone to clean it too.
Yeah.
You
Hopefully
know,
it's organic food though.
Fingers crossed. Yeah, although it's hard. I mean, it's hard to actually make that delineation when you go out to eat.
Totally. That's another thing. Yeah, we live in a bubble here in Portland.
Yeah,
we have a whole backstory on where our food comes from. I love that. But
yeah,
it's not. You're not getting that at Chili's.
Yeah, and then right. So you go out to a restaurant, they bring you your food, and then you've got like your paper napkin that barely works. Yeah. You know, like
you're. You can start on that the wax paper thing that just smears stuff around.
Yeah, you know, maybe you're like spending like $120 on sushi for two or whatever, but like you're using those like cheap like
bamboo.
disposable bamboo chopsticks. It drives me crazy.
That rant we had about like sitting down, we've just accepted that. It's like somebody at some point was like, it's cheaper, but you've lost
it's
the experience.
Cheaper.
And it's something about the experience. Also, once again, like when you're actually, you save that little bit of money, but you've cut so much down and
it's
the single use stuff, like we could talk, that's another episode right there.
But the point is like, there's still this residue of I want to be the king.
They didn't eat with plastic forks.
They didn't eat with plastic forks, and they were not eating or living in those teeny tiny little apartments that we live in.
They didn't
have wax paper
napkins.
We've gone beyond the logic of like this cultural thing.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
We already know that AI data centers use an unbelievable amount of water, but that's just one side of the AI climate equation. AI data centers need constant power, which means they can't rely on technologies like wind and solar. And on average, they tend to use dirtier, carbon-powered electricity. To support AI's demand for stable power, fossil fuel plants are staying online longer than planned. And the rush to push energy-hungry AI into every sector of our lives means that tech giants' climate impact is soaring. For instance, Google's greenhouse gas emissions in 2023 were 48% higher than in 2019, which it attributes to the energy needed by its AI data centers. Tech companies like Meta, Amazon, and Google have responded to their fossil fuel issue by announcing goals to use more nuclear power. Meta and Microsoft are actually already working on bringing new nuclear power plants online. And in April 2025, Elon Musk's X supercomputing center near Memphis was found to be using dozens of methane gas generators that were unpermitted and in violation of the Clean Air Act. An analysis of agreements between utility companies and tech companies like Meta revealed that discounts given to tech companies are offset by increased electricity rates paid by consumers like you and me. While AI's energy consumption is the metaphorical elephant in the room, it can actually be quite difficult to get an accurate picture of the energy consumption of AI because of the global nature of the network of data centers a particular query might run through. That and secrecy. And, of course, the amount of energy consumed depends on the AI model being used, the prompt, and the output. A 2025 MIT analysis provides two helpful estimates. A smaller AI model with a text-generating prompt uses an estimated total of 114 joules, or about what it takes to ride 6 feet on an e-bike. A larger AI model with a text-generating prompt uses an estimated total of 6,706 joules, or about what it takes to ride 400 feet on an e-bike. That may not sound like much, but when you take into consideration that Google processes roughly 16.4 billion searches per day, it starts to add up. Using the lower estimate, the electricity used to generate the AI overview results for Google's 16.4 billion daily searches could power 748 rides around the Earth on an e-bike. Using the higher estimate, the number skyrockets to roughly 49,894 rides around the Earth on an e-bike. Every single day. So if you're ready to turn off AI overview results on your smartphone, let's go. For those of you watching on video, take a screenshot of these instructions. And for those of you just hearing my voice, we'll have these instructions in the show notes for you. So there is actually an AI-free and even ad-free version of the Google search engine. It's called UDM equals 1.4, and you can add it as a custom search engine on your phone. As an iPhone user, I had to switch the browser I was using because, surprise, surprise, the default browser Safari doesn't allow you to set custom search engines. I ended up switching to Firefox on my smartphone. Open Firefox and tap the three dots on the bottom right of the screen. Select Settings and then Search. Tap Add Search Engine. In the title field, I put No AI Google. And in the URL field, enter https://www.google.com/search?Firefox-B=Hyphen D=Dog %Q=%S%UDM=1.4. Then tap Save and set No AI Google as your default search engine. If you use a different browser, just search the name, the words Add Custom Search Engine, and your device name, and follow those instructions with this information. Firefox actually just made it even easier to turn off AI add-ons with its AI kill switch. Check it out. And if you're interested in turning off AI overview results on your laptop or desktop, I go into the step-by-step instructions in episode 1. We don't have to participate in the needless consumption of ridiculous amounts of energy to generate unwanted AI overview results. All right, New Humans fam. Let's get back into the episode.
So a theme that's been coming up for me as I go through these episodes is that we engage in all kinds of practices that don't make sense except for from an economic perspective, right? Money, short-term profit.
Shareholder values.
Shareholder values. So, you know, for instance, in this case, like the USDA estimates that in 2024, producers spent something like $400 million on pollinator services. And we know that managed bee populations are declining. Mm-hmm. And we know that monocropping and monoculture practices contribute to that in part through the use of pesticides, right? We also know that most farm subsidies in the U.S. go to support monoculture and monocropping.
Yeah, the chemical companies.
Chemical companies, right? And the president just recently approved additional production of glyphosate, the pesticide?
Herbicide.
The herbicide glyphosate in the U.S. and granted immunity to the producers of that chemical.
Yeah.
So can you help us understand, like, what is going on here? Why are we doing this?
I don't know who's driving the ship anymore, but it's clearly the money, from my personal opinion there. You know, glyphosate impacts, it's for you know, controlling other plants. So it impacts pollinators in the sense where you get the spray over and stuff because it kills the plants that aren't bioengineered to resist it, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, that eliminates the biodiversity. So that's the issue there to them as the context are pollinators. But the immunity is, you know, as you see, when you reduce that, it's really hard to make case law to hold people accountable when we find out to right the wrong leader. Checks and balances, we have that for a reason. They just got rid of that one.
Not anymore.
Blah, blah. Sad trombone.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to see this doubling down on these policy choices that we know lead to bad outcomes. Mm-hmm. And this concept of we need it because we need to feed people is bullshit.
Yeah, who are we feeding with it, really? Yeah.
Well, right, because first of all, we don't need to continue with conventional practices.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we have alternatives.
There'll be a latency, right? You know, because you can't just flip a switch.
Sure.
Right? So, but, you know, but back to, like, people working together. So it's like the idea here is, you know, it's quite brazen, maybe is a good word to use there for this, like, you know, we're going to do this, but...
We're going to do this, and we know it's contributing to ecological collapse. Mm. We know that it's causing cancers. Mm-hmm. We know that it's also contributing to the decline of the managed bee populations that we need.
Or in the wild, too, This is everything, every population.
Right.
You know, it's not singular, but yeah.
Right, and you know, like, let's just note, right, like, we have this concept, like, we can just shoot, I mean... What we're doing, right, is just spraying poison all over the earth, right?
We
something
love it.
Something like 40% of all, or I don't quite remember the number, it's something like 40% of all habitable land on the planet is dedicated to agriculture, right? So nearly 40% of the land on this planet we are doing this to. And, you know, it's the human perspective is so... interesting, because we look out on this world and we're like, oh my God, it's so big.
And it, so, is.
It is.
And people just can't wrap their head around, like I do, because I look at it from like, you know, 1 to 10,000 scale.
Right.
But it's huge, massive.
Right. But it's still a closed system.
We are all one.
Yeah. And so, you know, we spray these chemicals year after year after year, and it just accumulates in our system.
Totally.
And so, you know, I see the president doing this. And my question's like, is it like we're trying to squeeze as much profit out of this system before it fully collapses? Or is it like... we actually want the population to be eating this poisoned food and experiencing the impacts of it?
Maybe. I don't know. I would say that I try to look at the world through most things are inherently good. So it might just be misinformation, right? You have a lot of money influence. Will you pollute somewhere on the earth if it's temporarily... it's, you know, it might not impact you today or tomorrow, but at some point, it's all going to come back around. It gets in the water, it gets in the fish, we eat the fish, right? Or the fish swim up and die and whatever. It's, everything's connected. So, you know, when we don't look, the balance sheet of today really doesn't ever really reflect the actual balance sheet of 100 years from now or tomorrow. And we've said this together, you know, the convenience of today generally is robbed tenfold of tomorrow, you know, so.
Right. Well, and you've said to me before, the solution to pollution is dilution.
That's another thing, too, because we set safe limits, but then that's also artificial when you think about it. A lot of chemists know this.
Yeah.
So you go to any well-known person that does this stuff, and you go in their house and half the stuff that's most people are buying are not in the really, you know, I have lots of people grew up where I'm from. Chemical engineering was a massive industry because that's what was there. And most of them growing up were using vinegar to clean their house, you know, because they're like, screw that.
Because they know.
Scrubbing bubbles, you know, unfortunately.
I mean, just to kind of come back to the dilution concept, it's like you can only dilute so much once you get to a certain concentration.
Totally. You're right. So it's like. You get these toxic waste oceans, you know.
Toxic waste fields.
Yeah, and that's another thing. You know, we talk about there's, like, on top of these pollinator collapses, there's also, like, the aridification of, you know, by using this stuff, we're, you know, making soils less productive because we're removing...
We're killing all of the microorganisms that actually exist in the soil to make the soil healthy and able to grow.
They actually do a pretty good job, but we created, you know, we're like, we're going to hit the afterburner for growing this wheat, right? And it's just the same thing, right? Like, it's the short-term gain, you know? You know, maybe a few hundred years ago when you had to really worry about that stuff because we didn't really have a lot of the advancements of food storage and stuff. But then it goes back down to, like, we throw a lot of our food away. So it's like we're creating all this yield, but then we just literally throw it in a landfill with other stuff. So it's not even like we're, like, creating, like, because that's bioresources that you can use.
Yeah.
And you just put it with the plastic, and then it's like you've locked that... you know, everything's finite here, right? So we only have so much whatever on the planet, so...
Including the nutrients that are in our food.
Yeah, and when you put poison on it or you bury it with other stuff you don't want to eat, it's like, it's congratulations.
Gone. Yeah.
maybe when the earth digests it and burps it out through a volcano, it might be good then. I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah, I talk about this in episode 3.
Yeah, and it's like goosebumps.
I know.
Yeah.
Oh my God. One of the things that keeps me up at night sometimes is like thinking about all of the water that's trapped in plastic water bottles in landfills. Right.
Or so, sitting in the sun getting chemically leached.
Exactly.
I told you about that, watching an entire C5 worth of water just get tossed because they left it in the sun. I was like,
Yeah.
That keeps me up at night, too. That's why I have some baseline anxiety. I know too much, folks.
I know. Honestly, like, I feel for you.
Does it make sense a little bit why I'm like, Everything's on fire.
No, because you see the big picture, right? And you see all of the like systematic changes that need to be made, that aren't happening and aren't happening as quickly as they need to be made.
Sorry.
But so I understand, like, you're holding all of this. I mean, it makes sense. Anxiety and pain and
sadness.
Like, you are in slow motion, like processing all of this stuff for the collective.
On top of my own.
Yeah.
It's been rough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for seeing me.
Yeah.
It's not easy being knowledgeable. It's like, I don't want to read the books anymore. They all say the same thing.
Yeah.
And I think the sad thing really is we're reading some of this shit that's been talking about it since the 60s.
Yes, yeah. And. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, for instance, like this podcast.
Yeah.
I think that something that has been going on for decades, since the 60s, since when people started raising the alarms about this, right, is just, we need to get this message out. Mm-hmm. We need to collectively understand what is going on and what needs to change, and to also make those changes in our life, right, our lives. And so, yeah, it can be frustrating and sad to sort of see, like, gosh, we've been trying to talk to people about this for decades, and it's just getting worse. But we are now having this collective, connected conversation.
Yeah, global conversation.
Global conversation. It's happening. And people are starting to feel that, like, oh, yeah, no, we do need to make changes now.
And, you know, like, speaking from experience, I've set foot on damn near every continent. I've met a lot of different people. And something I can say with conviction here is we're all the same. We all want the same basic stuff.
Yeah.
And so no matter what it is, and, you know, unfortunately, the old way of thinking of zero-sum game, like, this country has to lose for me to win, it's just, it's archaic. That's, like, when we look at it, like, we're all brothers and sisters here on this planet.
The human
family. The human family. And when you break it down Barney style for most folks, you want your food, you want your water, and you want your family.
Yeah.
That's it. And I don't care which direction you wake up in the morning, what God do you pray to, whatever, it's the same, you know, and unfortunately, when we don't look at nature that way, it's like we're also on this planet as, you know, with the things that are here too. And so when we're all in balance, it's quite prosperous. And you mentioned the 60s, like there was, you know, a lot of economic prosperity there post-war, hopefully with advancements of sharing information, like on these types of stuff. So we're the most informed.
More collective awareness,
you know, and when we really focus on the good, instead of just being, you know, biting the bait of the propaganda to be scared and, you know, consume, because, you know, consumption right there, there's a lot of science and stuff behind anxiety and stuff, mindless consumption.
Mm-hmm.
When we're all looking at each other like, I have enough. We're just some, you know, like, what does my brother need? Or what does my neighbor need? You know, we'll get back to that. And we're thinking on a global scale. I think it would really help this problem, too.
Right. Well, and it's what you just said, too. It's taking ownership of where you can contribute.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because it's, you know, so long, again, we've been consumers.
Mm-hmm.
We've been like, someone else is taking care of this problem. They haven't been. Someone else is taking care of
we
this, and like, and like, I'm just gonna keep going on, you know, doing my thing. But we also have to all now. I think what I'm trying to say, and I think we're all starting to understand this, is that we all need to take ownership of how we're plugged into perpetuating these systems, right? So this is again, like, if you're still buying conventionally grown food, like, know that that's not an option that you should be supporting anymore, right? Mm-hmm. Like, because that's supporting the glyphosate, supporting the neonic, I can't say it.
Neonicotoids.
Neonicotoids, et cetera, mm-hmm. right? And so despite what the government might be doing, we know that we need to get off of this train.
Because we can vote with our dollars or our feet.
Yes.
And you're also realizing that, like, you eat less of the good food because there's more nutrients there, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the pollinators thrive, it's like we thrive, too, right?
Right.
So, and, like, eat an organic orange. Caracara oranges,
so
they're
good.
In right now.
So good, yeah.
So good. But, like, another thing here is, like, they taste better.
Yes.
Generally.
Yes.
You know?
Tastes better. It's better for you. And the other thing, I mean, you said you eat less, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think part of what happens too when you get invested in the value and when you get invested in your food is that you start to understand, like, this is a precious resource.
Totally.
You know, it's just a different mindset and different relationship to food, I think.
Totally.
Yeah.
And, you know, it goes back down to, like, the choices that we're making here has more nutrient value, so you don't need to eat as much, and the other ones have less nutrients in it and more sugar, right? So your body still needs the, you know, whatever, the magnesiums and all the other associated stuff and the sugar, you know, but we're seeing that, you know, that too. Less poison, better food, it's good for you, it's good for the bees and the birds, so
and the butterflies. So we've been talking about decline in bee populations. Is this just a problem that impacts the U.S., or is this something that's happening in other countries as
global.
Well?
Global.
It's global.
We talked about losing pollinators and having to revert to hiring humans, or not.
Having humans.
You know,
yeah.
China is a really good example where they're using paintbrushes, you know. In China, it's like work groups of people, you know, maybe are interned in camps of whatever you want to, you know, political... prisoners or whatever. It's like generally who are the types of people that are using that. And China's gotten better. We don't hear that a lot in our modern news, but you know, if you go over there and know people there, that they've understood that, like, oh, this costs our healthcare system and this is not good for business. They're really good business. You know, they care. Mm. They think in Chinese culture, thinks in dynasties, right? So they've been doing things on 100-year scales for a lot longer than we have, right?
Yeah.
So they're catching up to that as well, from what I'm aware of, but they still have their areas where they've accepted that this is where they have to do that at, you know, the chicken and egg or the trolley problem.
I've read that hand pollination by humans is actually very inefficient, right? Like whereas a bee can go in and is designed to pollinate.
Yeah, their whole body.
Right? But with human pollination, it's like we go in like 5 times.
Yeah, it's an energy expelled too, right? Like the human's got to eat food. Right? It's the bees too, right? But the bee is eating while pollinating, right? So it's like you've reduced that, you know, that coefficient of energy expending, right? We're just walking along with a paintbrush.
Right. And you said this earlier, but like let's just bring it out a little bit more. I mean, like, are people signing up to do this hand pollination in China?
Do you want to go paint plants?
And is it voluntary?
From what I know, no. But I'm not out there, so I can't.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that it's probably not.
Or at least there's at least a portion of
what's
happening.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably the lower class of people, much like, you know, anywhere that the work is being done, you know. From my understanding, some of these, you know, those types of efforts are
people in camps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a human crisis, too.
Right.
She's like, you're screwing the bees over and the people over. Like, come on, we can do better than that.
Yeah. Well, and this is really interesting, right? Because, like, one of the things that's been coming up for me in recent months, right, is, like, you hear about the billionaires who are building these, like, bunkers, right, for the apocalypse or whatever. And, like, the question for me is, like, okay, billionaires, but, like, what the fuck are you going to do when you realize that you don't have any practical skills? But right, so, like, you're going to grow all your own food, but then you also see that we have ice snatching people up from the streets, and you have the development of all of these, effectively concentration camps happening here.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for me, I'm starting to wonder, like, and I'm not trying to speculate, but I'm kind of like wondering, like, do these pieces go together?
Hopefully not.
Yeah. Right. But like, but I wonder, because we know that the billionaires and the government are.
Yeah. Right now. Right. Bought and paid for.
Yeah. And so there's part of me that wonders, like, is the plan to actually put people that are in these detention centers into involuntary labor in order to have them hand pollinate and do all their other kinds of cultivation?
Yeah, I don't think we're quite there yet, because we still have the populations. And look, I'm just a worker bee, you know, what I do for work. So, like, hopefully the idea is you have an educated population to not have that, you know. But I don't know.
Yeah.
It's speculative. Right? We're in 100%. A theoretical, too, right? Like, this could be all just, like, fear-mongering, too.
And I'm not here to do that, but I am here to say, I see these pieces. I see that they could be moving together.
Yeah, that scares the shit out of me every night.
We know, we know that this administration has authoritarian, like, an authoritarian agenda. And so, you know, the situation we're faced with as a collective is, do we take ownership of the situation that's facing us and work collectively to address it so that whatever the administration and the billionaires might be planning becomes irrelevant because we're not cooperating with it. We're actually getting off the trolley and we're addressing it ourselves.
Yeah. I don't know, my personal opinion, I have, it keeps you up at night because you don't want it to be the more negative doom and gloom.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there is a lot of people who do care, I think, still out there. That they're just trying their damnedest just to show up and do what's right for humanity, you know.
Yes.
They're not taking a partisan approach to their jobs. They're not supposed to, you know. So I think, I really believe in that, too. So there's folks out here who's like, a lot of it's just noise.
Mm-hmm.
We still have work to do. I can get distracted on what could be, but we can also just look at what should be.
Yeah. And so what should be is
people working together.
Yeah.
For the collective good.
Yeah.
You know, because
exactly.
when we all thrive, it's the rising tides raise all ships, right?
Yes.
So, because I don't want to live in a world that looks like what you were describing. I don't want it either. Yeah.
I don't want it either.
And I'm sure some of the billionaires don't either, if they really knew I'm going to go back to that too. I wouldn't want to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, it's like, we so often see in, you know, the mega corporate, ultra wealthy sort of mindset, right? This goes also back to the president's approval of more glyphosate production, right? Mm. It's like, we just kind of keep moving in the same direction and saying like, oh, well, you know, this amount didn't work. Let's put more on. Oh, that amount didn't, let's do it some more, you know? And, you know, there's this like following the same pattern of behavior to its just completely absurd logical extreme, which potentially could be
extinction level events
where we're in a situation where we have to hand pollinate and it is not economically sustainable to do that, paying people minimum wage.
That's a kind of a conundrum to think about.
So it's like if we allow this process to continue in the way it's going, that's a possible future. And based on some of the activities that some of these people have been doing and supporting, I would not count it outside of the realm of possibility. I will take responsibility right now for bringing this concept into the room, right?
More people need to be like you.
I would not discount that possibility, particularly against the background of what we're hearing about the building of concentration camps in this country, right? And so I just want to raise that as a possibility, not to fear-monger, but to say, do we trust these people to be driving our future, particularly when it comes to food stability and the long-term sort of viability of our food system, right?
Yeah.
And frankly, no. No, I don't, you know? And so then it's like, okay, well, collective, like, let's step the fuck up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of people who are, like, wanting to do the food co-ops and, this, you know, doing the CSAs. Like, I belong to Peoples here in Portland.
Yes.
You know, I own my own grocery store.
Yes.
If you want to, you know, done right, my dad would say do it yourself. So maybe that's time for that. I don't know.
Yes.
You say a lot of interesting things about, do you trust these people? And I guess that's a personal question for everyone, right? And I think for anybody, in my personal judgment of things, is actions speak louder than words.
So actions, like, speak, you know, so loud.
But we're not disempowered enough to where we can't change our own realities. You know, I'm seeing that. There's still hope in time, right? We still have the mechanisms to.
Totally.
And the inaction is worse. You know, some action is better than no inaction. So
yes.
It's just got to pick where it's at.
Yes.
Voting with your dollars, whatever, you know, demanding change. You know, however you got to do to survive, mm-hmm. I think is the key. And anybody... that's a personal judgment. And I think, you know, there's a lot of, that's a very deep topic to get into. You know, there's a lot of intrinsic barriers there, but.
Yeah. Well, and I think too, you know, you said empowered, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like the reason we have felt, we are only as unempowered as we allow ourselves to be.
It's a thought.
It's a mental prison,
yeah.
Right? And the other thing that I think people really underestimate is the regenerative power of this planet.
Totally.
Of the regenerative, like, healing capabilities
yeah.
of this planet.
It's self-healing.
It's self-healing. Mm. We just have to stop poisoning
yeah.
it all the time.
We just
got to
take a step back and let it breathe. The pandemic. We learned so much during the pandemic. We learned.
Yes.
Yeah, if the food supply gets so bad, you vote when you just start. You might learn how to grow stuff in your house. And that might teach you that you need to buy some land. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Growing indoors for me has not been super successful.
Yeah. Sometimes you gotta let people just do it and learn it, you know? Like, all right, well, that's not how you do it. So, but yeah, maybe it's time for the collective awakening, and there's folks that are the pillars like yourself to, like, be like, hey, I cared about this and here's my story, you know?
Yeah.
Getting back to that neighborly thing. But, you know, in recent history, people are easily persuaded with whatever means. So if we're consuming information that is enriching ourselves and wise enough to know it, I think that's, you know, we can heal. And even stop doing stuff during the pandemic. And like, the whales came back into the Hudson Bay, you know, that was amazing. So it's like, but then we saw it everywhere, deer, all this stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, there's, pollinators is a really good example, but it really is an ecological thing. And that's like, you know, looking at landscape ecology, it's like you really do have to scale back out. And yeah, we're one human, but we do have a massive impact. If you think about like what one human in America is, like our carbon footprint alone,
mm-hmm.
right? But when we make simple choices and changes, it radiates up. And
yeah.
when you add the people together, you know, that's something is more than nothing.
Thank you for bringing that up, because, you know, one of the phrases that people so often kind of come to with stuff like this is like, it's just a drop in the bucket. What does it matter? And it's like, well, think about that, because a bucket is a finite space.
It's a shit excuse.
Let's
call it what it is.
But put your drop in the bucket,
yeah.
and I'll put my drop in, and you put your drop in, and eventually...
We can water something with that bucket.
We're going to fill it up.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, totally.
Yes. Put it in there.
Put it in the bucket. And you know what? I can never make a change. Well, yeah, with that attitude, you can't. My dad would say that.
Yeah, your dad is a smart man.
He's a very wise man.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think you do have the power to change. You have the power to change your own reality.
Mm-hmm.
I'm recently woken up, so I'm learning how to do it. But
it's fun.
Because you're like,
fun.
I'm just going to manifest that. I'm going to manifest not eating poison.
Mm-hmm.
That was a simple one.
Mm-hmm.
It took a lot of frustration of learning and then being like,
How do you feel now, though, since you dedicated yourself more to like eating more organically? How did that impact you and your?
Well, actually, I have an interesting story about this. So
sure.
I was living in Europe, where things were heavily regulated,
mm-hmm.
and it was easier access to food. And at the time, you know, I was doing all this cool guy special operations stuff. So it was like I was having to hit the gym a lot, right? And I was eating a lot. And then, but I was really in tune with my body, you know, we weren't, you have a pretty strict regimen of what you can and can't do. So like, you know, I was tapped into like how things made me feel. So, I was in really good shape when I came back into the States, you know, like, it was like, you know, look like a poster child for something, right? And but my diet didn't change because I was doing these workouts, and I got so sick within a few months, like to the point where they thought I had Crohn's disease.
Whoa!
And I was like 25, 26, or 27, so like not old enough to like whoa. And it came out of nowhere, and like I got a colonoscopy, all this stuff. Went and saw a dietitian, and it ended up being like food aversion, you know. Cut pork out of my diet, stuff like that. But what changed is where I was buying my food. Like, I've always bought organic produce, but now it's like, give me that organic pasta and like not putting the other stuff in. Like, shit's in her beer too. I loved beer.
Yeah.
I used to brew, you know, and then it was like making me feel sick. And once again, it's like our cereal grains got glyphosate on it. And it's like only recently, when we were kids, our Wonder Bread didn't have glyphosate. You know?
That lived the Wonder Bread dream.
We did. They took it from us. Like everything else in the millennial thing. They took our dreams. They poisoned our fucking Wonder Bread. Like, kick me anymore. Like, you know, like, and that's, you know, it sucks. But at the end of the day, you know, like, in the last 5 years, I don't eat bread here, but I go to Europe, fat kid comes out in me because I can.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference is there's less poison on the food over there.
Yeah. Well, right, and it's, you know, for anyone who hasn't done this detox from the conventionally grown food, it's like, you might be sitting there being like, I don't know what you're talking about, I eat food, I feel fucking fine, right?
Yeah.
But you don't, because it's that frog in the boiling water thing. Mm-hmm. It's like, you've been living so long with the inflammation and just the toxins in your system that you become desensitized and numb to feeling it. But once you get that out of your system and then like reintroduce it, because I don't know, you had a craving or you were in a place where they didn't have organic food or whatever, right? You're just like,
it
I'm fine,
good.
I'll just eat it. Then you can really feel the effects of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I, you know, it's like the poor bees, you know? They don't got a choice. It's not like they can go to the organic section. They don't know.
I was thinking about this, like, as I was getting ready for this episode, thinking about these bees, right? Okay, so we have managed bee populations. We're putting them in particular places that are poisoned. I mean, we've basically enslaved these bees.
I mean, you said we might be doing that to humans.
And we might be doing that.
Are we foreshadowing something? I don't know.
One of the concepts that you've kind of pointed to or raised a couple of times during this conversation is this concept of habitat fragmentation.
Mm-hmm.
Can you kind of give us an explanation of what that means and how it's come about?
You ever flown on an airplane and you're above and you look out the window and everything's kind of like a checkerboard?
Yeah.
That's fragmentation right there.
Mm-hmm.
A little homework for the listeners. Go on your Google Earth and scroll out, turn that satellite image in, look at it. Look at the difference of the squares. And we've drew our little, you know, squares on the planet. We're terraforming. So while doing that, we've made things disconnected.
Mm.
Weird. It's almost like there's a theme here. We get disconnected from our bodies. We get disconnected from nature. We treat nature as a foreign entity and not realize that we are it.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing that, we disrupt the flow. Like, we don't look at lands the way that indigenous populations did. You know, we just don't.
Right. I mean, we look and we see something to be exploited, taken advantage of, built on, whatever. But what we don't see is all of the populations and the ecosystems that exist there already, all the networks, the complex network. What I'm understanding from you about habitat fragmentation, right, is that humans come in, we build our buildings, we build our infrastructure, whatever, without any care to sort of what's happening for other species, populations. And then you get a situation where the remaining sort of natural areas are either so disparate or so small or don't even have the kinds of plants on them that bees pollinate and eat from that suddenly now you don't have that underlying nature to support these populations.
And that's kind of what we're looking at here too with what some of the projects like mine are, you know, and it goes down to like sustainable design. It's a huge part of my studies as well. It's like,
we can actually design things to be dual use, right? You know, it's like putting the solar panels in areas that make sense, you know?
Right.
It's looking at things holistically. And, you know, something I read recently is like some of the most successful businesses today in today's economy are looking at things or hiring people like me, the ecologist, because it's like nature has to survive through, you know, the feast and famine. So like it kind of does come back down to the fact that like we can and should do better.
Okay. So are there any concrete things that listeners can do in their own lives to sort of help change or defragment pollinator habitats?
Less concrete. Yeah, it's changing the way that we look at things, you know, like planting the natives, having a diverse flora. If you want to, like, in your own lives, if you're looking at just supporting a pollinator to give them food, yeah, that's what you do. You also care about what you're buying and places you're going to. It's not supporting the entities that don't align with those values too, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, what we've heard is plant native plants, local wildflowers, eat organic.
Yeah.
And what was the other one? Oh, don't use pesticides.
Don't use pesticides. No more poison.
No more poison.
We're better than that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are there any organizations or programs that listeners can go to sort of get more information, you know, if they're wanting to sort of do something to help support their local pollinator species?
Yeah. Soil and Water Conservation Districts, which is, funded by the government, and there's a lot of nonprofits in local areas, so like Simple Search. If you want bee and pollinator specific, Xerces Society's local here in Portland is like world renowned. Lots of information there, and donating to those types of folks too. So if you can't really get involved, but you got a couple extra dollars, with the charity, you know.
Yeah.
So that's probably what I would recommend. But there is a lot of resources out there, local farmers markets and all kinds of stuff. There's probably a pamphlet for everything. I would assume. We're still doing that, right?
Yeah, right. So Xerces
would be my one.
Okay, great. And we'll have that link in the show notes for everyone. Well, awesome. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been fun to nerd out with the bees. Save the bees and do it for the birds. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of the New Humans for New Earth podcast. I'm Queenie. If you found this episode to be inspirational, helpful, or informative, please share it with your friends, your partner, a family member, or anyone that you love. If you loved this episode, please leave a review. And be sure to subscribe wherever you're listening to this podcast. This is how we grow the New Humans community and help inspire others to join us in co-creating New Earth. This world is what we make it. Thank you so much for being here. And we'll see you in the next episode.